In his book Hitler and the Nazi Darwinian Worldview, author Dr. Jerry Bergman takes a fresh look at Germany's most influential Nazi leaders, examining their backgrounds, education, and convictions. Dr. Bergman provides compelling evidence that the rising influence of Darwinism, eugenics, and race theory in early 20th century society set the foundation for the Nazi pursuit of engineering a German master race and exterminating European Jews, Gypsies, Blacks, most Slavs, and the Christian religion in the ensuing madness of the Holocaust of World War II. Stay tuned for a riveting conversation about the dark roots and effects of social Darwinism with Dr. Jerry Bergman on this episode of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko.
The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of other things. Of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings.
My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Hello, and welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
Welcome, friends. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Soaring Eagle Radio. You can listen to every episode on iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And you can listen to every episode on our website, SoaringEagleRadio.com. Jerry Bergman has taught biology, genetics, chemistry, biochemistry, anthropology, geology, and microbiology at the college and university level for over 40 years. Dr. Bergman has taught at the University of Toledo Medical School and Bowling Green State University in Ohio. He was selected by his students for Who's Who Among America's Teachers in 2000 and 2005. Dr. Bergman has over 900 science publications to his credit in 12 languages, has published 30 books and monographs, and has been a consultant for over 20 science textbooks. He has spoken frequently about his research on American radio and television programs and at conferences throughout the world. It's my pleasure and honor to welcome Dr. Jerry Bergman to the Soaring Eagle Radio program.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Well, thank you for joining me for this episode, Jerry. And we'll jump right into the text, your book, Hitler and the Nazi Darwinian Worldview, How the Nazi Eugenic Crusade for a Superior Race Caused the Greatest Holocaust in World History. Charles Darwin's theories concerning the origin of man and the superiority of certain races is, in my opinion, fraught with errors and leaps of speculation. It seems that Darwin's experience with the inhabitants of Tierra del Fuego convinced him that man evolved from savages, and those are Darwin's words, not mine, or perhaps even worse. But it seems, as I've read your book and looked at all of Darwin's writings, it seems that his ideas, Jerry, are also overtly racist. Now, I don't want to misread Darwin on that. So is that the opinion of scholars in the field as well, or am I reading too much into that?
No, that's the opinion of scholars in the field. For example, Thomas Chiders, who's professor of history at University of Pennsylvania, he said, and I quote, the greater German empire, talking about Nazi empire, was to be a racially pure empire. Germany was the last best race hope of mankind. End of quote, the Germans believed, the Nazis believed.
Wow.
And so it's here. Many references, I mean, this is just one of many, but
yes.
It's well recognized.
Yes.
Many books, though, cover things like the wars, the battles, the politics.
Mm-hmm.
But most of them at least mention how central racism was.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I bring that factor up, the racism factor, because it plays heavily into the thinking and the worldview of the Nazis and certainly their leader, Adolf Hitler. So let's start, Jerry, by laying the groundwork for our discussion by noting that the first foreign language that Darwin's Origin of the Species was translated into was German. And the Germans
Correct.
Seemed to take to it immediately, didn't they?
They did. In fact, Darwin himself said he was very encouraged by the fact that the Germans have taken to his ideas so readily and so, in many ways, so completely.
Yeah, and there was a... let's see if I can remember the guy's name. You spend some time talking about him in your textbook.
Ernst Haeckel,
that's it, yeah. He
yep.
became an ardent supporter of Darwinism, and there seems to be a pretty clear connection between Haeckel and Hitler. Could you take us through that?
Yeah, there was. In fact, the two had known each other, at least communicated with each other. Now, Darwin, of course, didn't know German, and so he had to rely upon the translators. And there were several translators who translated his famous work, his 1859, The Origin of Species, which, by the way, I should mention, never talked about the origin of species. It seemed to talk around the whole subject of where, indeed, various life forms came from.
That's a very
and
interesting...
Many commentators...
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. Never talked about the origin of species, talked all the way around it. I'd never heard it put that way before.
Yeah. Well, he didn't know the origin of species. All he could do is speculate and said, well, we know we can breed many animal kinds, and if we can breed many types of animals quite effectively, then obviously nature must be able to do the same thing. So he extrapolated human breeding skills to nature, to the natural world.
Mm.
And that's basically where he got his idea from. And he basically said there's really no limit. You can breed, in time, a dog into an animal like a horse. But, of course, we know there are very clear limits of what you can do. You can only breed so far, and in many cases we've done that, and we haven't been able to go the next step.
Yes.
There's a wall, it seems,
yes.
that all breeding experiments reach, and to go beyond that is very difficult.
Yes, yeah, from one species to another, only in kind.
Right.
So Hitler adopted Hegel's views and the applications, I guess we could say, of Darwinian evolutionary theory, and he related that to human beings. But there's
right.
still a huge right. challenge in front of Hitler, and so I'm wondering if you could explain to our listeners how Hitler went about spreading this across Germany. Did he specifically target any institutions as necessary to the successful indoctrination of the ideas of Darwin?
Well, not only he did, but he had enormous cooperation from the academic establishment in Germany at the time.
Mm.
As a matter of fact, in some ways, the academic establishment were more concerned about developing the superior race and eliminating the inferior races than Hitler was. In fact, several times Hitler had to slow them down and say, you know, wait a minute, we can't do this overnight. It takes us 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years, and actually, of course, did. And how Hitler and his followers did it was really quite interesting, step at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Took them almost 12 years. The concentration camps for extermination were not set up until, 1943, 1944?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was like 10 years into the Nazi movement. So it took them a while, but their goals were very clear.
Yeah.
And Hitler made his goals and his followers' goals very clear. And we often epitomize the whole movement as Hitler, and Hitler is only one part of the movement. And he had enormous support and cooperation from many
yeah.
many different people.
Yeah. I think one of the associations or organizations that assisted in that was, I think it was called the Association of German Students. I think they were instrumental.
That was one of
many. They established really the anti-Semitism as a national mindset. What role did this organization play? Because if I remember reading about them in your book, Jerry, they were actually involved in the propaganda of Darwinism even before Hitler became the Führer.
There are many groups that were. In fact, if you look at the German textbooks, they propagated the Nazi worldview and the idea of inferiority in many of the leading German textbooks. In many ways, Hitler didn't really have to prod or encourage. To some degree, what he did is gave them permission. In fact, the first euthanasia act they performed was on a young German boy that was severely deformed, and they basically asked Hitler's permission to euthanize his child.
Mm-hmm.
And Hitler said yes, and of course, as far as they were concerned, that opened the door to euthanasia, to massive euthanasia. And they were concerned whether Hitler would give them permission. Of course, he did. And when he did, they were elated because now they had the entrepreneur of the Führer in order to carry out their programs. In fact, many psychiatrists noted what we're doing is cleaning out our mental hospitals. We're putting ourselves out of a job. The first step, of course, was people who are, from Hitler's standpoint and the Nazi standpoint, obviously inferior. Those that were deformed, that were retarded, Down syndrome, and so on.
Yeah.
And then they extended that in time to groups that we would not see as retarded or deformed at all, but they were of the minority race. And when we talk about race, we usually focus on Jews, but actually he killed more Slavics than Jews, and his goal was very clear. That is, eventually, he wanted to wipe out the Slavic population. Eventually, all of Europe and all the world would be Aryan, which is German, Swedish, and Norwegian, and the Scandinavian countries. So his goals were made very clear, actually, in a book which today is called The Second Book of Hitler. And he detailed what his world goal was. That book was never published, probably because he realized that people knew what he wanted to do, there would be opposition. So he wrote the manuscript, he completed it, but it was never published until after he died. And the first step was to authenticate this book, which they did quite successfully. Found indeed that it was written by him. It had the phraseology, the style of language that he used. And it's pretty clear that indeed what his goals were. But you can't tell your enemies what your end goal is, of course, because then they'll know where you're going.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a good reason why he didn't publish it, but he intended to eventually. But of course, things didn't turn out that way, and he ended up not publishing it. And the manuscript was located and has been published since then.
Yeah. There's another organization that you mentioned in your book, and again, this predates the Nazis, and I was very surprised to read about the German Society for Racial Hygiene. The group was formed in 1905. It had its mission statement, and I'm just going to read this, and for our listeners, again, I would encourage you to pick up a copy of Dr. Bergman's book, Hitler and the Nazi Darwinian Worldview. On page 20 of my copy, this is the mission statement of the German Society for Racial Hygiene, again founded in 1905. The mission statement of the organization, to propagate the doctrine of racial purity as the sole means to stem the genetic decline of German Volk. It applied principles of animal and plant husbandry, and you alluded to that just a few moments ago, Jerry. So it applied principles of animal and plant husbandry to human society, in other words, social biology, thus foreshadowing national socialist racism, which is social Darwinism, and it dissolved at the war's end in 1945. It seems that more than any other organization, Jerry, the German Society for Racial Hygiene gave could we say respectability and scientific cover for Hitler's policies? Is that an accurate statement?
Oh, yes. Yes, it did. And by racial hygiene, that was a code word for euthanasia of those that they deemed inferior. So they used a lot of terms such as hygiene, mental hygiene, racial hygiene, which sounded better than actually what they were doing. So the Germans were pretty good in using code words, terms that did not sound nearly onerous, but in fact, they refer to something that we would find pretty difficult to accept. And they knew the same would be true of the German people, so they had to be careful. They had to be respond in such a way, well, like the pro-abortion movement, basically. They keep talking about women's health, and
yes.
We know what they're referring to in most cases is they're talking about abortion.
That's right. Yeah. Well, after Hitler became Führer, one of the first things he did was implement what was called the Nuremberg Racial Laws of 1935. Hitler referred to them as the laws for the protection of German blood and German honor. Again, that sounds like just a bunch of euphemisms for what he was really up to, because that law, in effect, it laid the groundwork for legal racism and for the coming persecution of targeted ethnicities, didn't it?
It did. That's exactly what it did. And again, they use terminology which is not too objectionable, but when you look behind the terminology, of course, what they wanted to do was basically eliminate a good deal of their population. The Jews were themselves a small percent, the Slavics were an enormous percent. And many Germans had intermarried with Slavics, which made it even more difficult. Well, as well as Jews and non-Jews, many intermarried. So they had to come up with a way of determining who was a Jew. And they debated basically between one and two grandparents. If they were Jewish, then you were Jewish. And that was hard to come down with because so many prominent German generals and other high military officials had a grandfather or two grandparents that were Jewish. And so finally it came down where Hitler, in fact, Goering and others were claimed to have said this, but they said basically, probably several did, they said, I will determine who is a Jew. And many people who would be considered Jewish under the Nuremberg and other laws were determined non-Jewish. So to some degree, they had to say, well, this person is not a Jew, even though according to their definition, they were. So that was a problem, especially in Germany, because so many well-known and influential Germans, especially in the military, were Jewish according to their own definition. Mm-hmm. So and that, I think, illustrates the problem of their whole racial idea. If you have a hard time telling who's Jewish, you know, how can you claim they're inferior? The most ludicrous thing, of course, is where they had to wear a Star of David. So if they're racially inferior, you should be able to look at them and tell that. But they couldn't do that, so therefore they had to wear the Star of David. And that let people know that this person was Jewish. And, of course, eventually then they put those people in the concentration camps and they were murdered.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Jerry, a quote from Fritz Redlich's book you've included in your book, Redlich's book, Hitler, Diagnosis of a Destructive Prophet, explains the link, I thought quite well, between Darwinian evolutionary theory and war. And I want to quote that now for our listeners and then hear your comments. And this is from page 9 of my copy of your book, Jerry. It says, quote, Hitler came to view history as the struggle between the races, in which the strong defeat, dominate, or destroy the weak, a vulgarized view of social Darwinism, in which war plays a fundamental role. This notion became the center of Hitler's worldview and eventually contributed to unprecedented destruction. There is a clear link between Darwinian evolutionary theory and war, isn't there?
Oh, very clear link. And ironically, they said two things which were contradictory. One group said war eliminates the weak, okay? And the other group said, no, war eliminates the strong because, of course, to be part of the military, you generally had to have pass a physical and a mental and physical.
Mm-hmm.
And so war actually, the weak stayed at home. The strong went to war, and the strong, therefore, were more likely to be killed. So ironically, the idea of war was supported by two contradictory ideas.
Yes.
And some people felt that among the strong, it eliminates the weak among the strong, but of course it's ludicrous that when you get killed in war, it's almost always a matter of chance. You don't, kind of hard to dodge bullets. And by and large, chance is an incredibly important factor, and therefore it pretty well negates the whole idea of using war to eliminate the weak. But Hitler felt that for a race to be strong, that war is something that will have to go on forever. He didn't feel once World War II ended, and of course he thought he'd win, but he didn't feel that that's the end, we're done, we're finished. But he saw war as continuing a part of German life forever, evidently. Hmm. And because weakness, he felt, is propagated or encouraged when you're not at war. And so
wow.
they define things according to the worldview, and the worldview mm-hmm. is clearly Darwinian. Yeah. And that's why sometimes the definition and applications that they use is contradictory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sadly, many churches towed the Nazi propaganda party line. Now, there were a few notable exceptions, and I wonder if you would talk about the church's involvement, the church as collaborators with the Nazis, and then some of the men and even churches that stood against the Nazis at great price.
Well, of course, the most well-known is Bonhoeffer, who
yes.
recognized several problems, but he recognized that the Nazi movement was wrong, and the Confessing Church was a major church that opposed the Nazi movement. And by and large, most of the churches went along, partially because I think they were convinced that, indeed, Darwinism is science, racism is science, the need to eliminate the inferior races is science. That's how we got here, by elimination of the weak. And therefore, they tended, unfortunately today as well, they tend to go along with current scientific fads. And that has gotten the church in trouble so many times. They really stuck clear to the scriptures, wouldn't have had the problem. But so many of the churches in Germany were apostate, primarily because of the so-called higher criticism. And therefore, the leading German theologians pretty well abandoned basic Christianity, and therefore they were highly influenced by the whole German ideology. And, of course, many Christians were patriotic Germans, and they went along with their country.
Yes.
And also important to stress that how many knew exactly what the Darwinism effect had and what the Nazis were doing is not known. Some went to war because, well, they're drafted, and so they defend their country, and they weren't fully aware of the extent of the killing that the Nazis were doing. In fact, it got to be a problem when more and more people became aware, and that's when the Nazis set up the concentration camps. They first went out in the field, identified Jews, and shot them, basically, marched them out in the field and shot them. And as more and more people became aware of this, more and more people objected because they felt this is wrong, of course. And
sure.
So the next step was to put the Jews in, and others, inferior races, so-called inferior races, into trains and ship them to one place where the killing occurred. And many believed, including probably many German military men, believed that they were just being relocated to a camp, a work camp. But, of course, that's not what happened towards the end of the war. What they were being is shipped off to a place where you could kill massive numbers without the problems that you had when you openly killed. And many of these killings occurred right in front of the people in the village. They would march the Jews to a certain area, and the villagers would gather around and look and watch and see that the Jews and other, first the Jews, of course, were murdered. And so as time went on, more and more people became aware of what they were doing. And the Germans, the Nazis especially, tried very hard to put forth a good picture of what their country was doing. They supported the Red Cross, and it was humane, and Hitler said he loved his people so much, he sacrificed his family and marriage so he could be married to the German people and the German state. But, of course, it's more complex than that. He's hard to say why he never married, but mm-hmm. I don't think the reason he gave was the correct reason.
Right. Yeah. Well, let's address one of the one of several lingering errors concerning Hitler. Critics of Christianity always seem to try and argue that Hitler was a Christian. Now, that simply was not the case, was it?
No, that clearly wasn't the case. In fact, he was very opposed to Christianity. He made it very clear he wanted to eliminate Christianity. But he recognized that when you're fighting a war, you can't fight six wars at once. You can't fight Britain and Russia and Christianity and Judaism and so on. And his generals wanted to destroy Christianity fairly early. And Hitler said, no, we cannot fight every war. We've got to deal with one or two at a time. When we win the war against the East, primarily Russia, then later on we will concern ourselves with destroying Christianity.
Mm.
But, oh yeah, he was very hostile towards Christianity in many, many areas. Made that very clear, that he was opposed to Christianity. had a lot of things to say about Christianity which showed his contempt for Christianity. One major reason was, of course, Christianity stresses helping the weak, helping the poor, helping those who are handicapped, helping the people that Hitler wanted to kill. Mm-hmm. And so his goals were exactly contrary to what the goals are of Christianity. When you say the word Christian, people know you generally mean somebody who's loving and kind and supportive, and quite the opposite of what we think of when we think of a Nazi. And so Hitler recognized that, and he realized that we have an enemy, which is Christianity, but for now let's just work with him and let's deal with it. And wants to stress that Hitler did not have much opposition, but most of the opposition he did have was from the Christian church. And the Christian church did far too little too late. So that is a fault that certainly is historically been documented. But nonetheless, the fact is, of the small amount of opposition they had was from the church. In fact, a number of bishops were murdered by the Nazis, or sometimes in a public trial, they were condemned and hung. And there weren't many people outside the church that happened to. Primarily, it was after the church, especially church leaders who were critical of his regime.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Well, on that subject, you quote George Constable from his book, The New Order. And this is a quote from my copy of your book, Jerry, on page 13. It says, from the beginning, the Nazi Party had paid lip service to religious values, endorsing what it called a positive Christianity. What positive Christianity entailed, aside from opposition to Jews and Marxists, the Nazis never explained. Before taking power, Hitler studiously avoided conflict with the churches. Indeed, by supporting their independence and their proper role in the affairs of state, by opposing godless communism and espousing the moral regeneration of Germany, he appealed to thousands of individual Christians. And this is a quote from Hitler. I need the Catholics of Bavaria just as I need the Protestants of Prussia, he vowed.
So, yep.
He really played the straight face and proclaiming himself to be a religious, God-fearing person, and exactly the opposite was actually true. In fact, Hitler believed Christianity to be a satanic superstition. And that's a quote from your book, Jerry. And that hardly sounds like the words of a true follower of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, that's obvious. Although he did say a lot of very, quote, Christian things at first when he was coming to power. In fact, he sounded like a conservative, evangelical, born-again Christian in a few of his talks. Mm-hmm. But Hitler, if you can criticize him for many things, but one thing you can't criticize him for was he was a very good politician. He knew exactly how to influence the people, and he said the things that people wanted to hear, and of course, he was quite successful in achieving the power he did, and he almost conquered most of Europe. He had pretty much all of Northern Europe and Eastern Europe conquered, Western Europe conquered, and he really only had primarily Russia and Great Britain left from European areas to conquer. And so he was very successful in what he did. Surprisingly, a country about the size of Ohio and Michigan together, that small country basically conquered almost two entire continents. And so therefore, he did what many people would classify as impossible. In fact, many people feel, historians feel, that he was close to winning World War II, and that if America had not stepped in when they did, with enormous amount of might, and especially arms and planes and so on, that Hitler would have won World War II. He thought he was pretty much had won the war against Russia. Of course, the Russians mounted an enormous counteroffense later on, but nonetheless, without, I think, America's help, it's likely that Hitler would have indeed won World War II and would have ruled all of Europe. And then, of course, his goal eventually was to rule the rest of the world, including America. In fact, he was already making plans in the late 30s on how he was going to conquer America. And he had begun to implement those, but of course he did not implement those to the degree that we're very aware of what was going on. But indeed, his goal was to conquer pretty much the whole world, but as he said, a step at a time.
Yeah. And there are plenty of books out there, folks, that that you can get that bears Jerry's contention that Hitler had other plans for the rest of the world. And in fact, it's a well-known, historically established fact that many of Americans secretly supported Hitler and his war machine, and certainly many American corporations were still doing business with Hitler and the Nazis throughout World War II. And that's beyond the scope of our conversation today, but just for our listeners' information, those books are out there, and I would encourage you to avail yourself of those. Well, Jerry, let's dive into the meat of the book then. The Holocaust was, it's been described variously as a planned extermination of Europe's Jews. It clearly was an atrocity of historical proportions, yet it surprises me that we still have people today who deny that the Holocaust ever took place. I mean, some people are willing to admit something happened in Nazi-occupied land, but they deny the figures of millions of deaths, and they state rather vehemently that the real figures are only a couple hundred thousand, as if that would justify it somehow. How do you respond to people that are Holocaust deniers?
Well, one thing is that the Germans were famous for keeping incredibly good records, and they had an enormous number of records, and so a lot of this we can verify from the Germans' own records. And these were not made public, of course, during Nazi Germany, but after the war we were able to apprehend what went on by basically obtaining many of these records. In fact, it wasn't just many, it was truckloads of records that we utilized. And so we can develop fairly accurate scenario of what indeed Hitler was trying to do and what he accomplished. A lot of this was because of the Nuremberg trials. In order to carry on these trials, we had to basically know what was going on, because we really bent over backwards to give the Nazis a fair trial in the Nuremberg trials. And so at that time is when we were able to gather multi-millions of records, and they were studied. And so the Germans didn't have enough time to destroy all of these. They destroyed some, of course, but yeah, many of these records were not destroyed, because Eisenhower and others were very determined right away that we want to get these records so we can prove indeed what happened. In fact, after the war was over, Eisenhower recognized, he said, someday people are going to deny what happened. Mm-hmm. And so I want to make sure they don't deny what happened. And therefore, he ordered basically massive documentation of what happened, including photographs. And so photographers went in the camps, interviewed thousands of survivors, and photographed the bodies and the camps, so this would be well documented. And Eisenhower also required many of the townspeople to go in and see actually what the war had caused and what the Germans and Nazis had done. And there are a lot of moving pictures of the people going in, smiling and laughing and having a good time and well-dressed typically. And going out, they had a very different countenance on their face, very different attitude about what was happening. And again, Eisenhower made sure that this was very well documented, but with enormous footage and interviews with people and so on that were involved. And so it's not like waiting 30 years later and then digging into the records. It was documented very soon after the treaty was signed between this country and Germany, and very well documented. In fact, there are very few events in history that have been so well documented as the Holocaust and what the Nazis did to not only Jews, of course, but Slavics and other people. So you simply can't deny what happened. You can argue that over the numbers, you know, it might have been only 5,948,000, or it might have been 6,152,000, but we have pretty good record of not only the numbers of people, but also names and addresses. So when you're documenting this, you can document who died, when they died, how they died, because the Nazis kept all these records. You might wonder why they want to keep them, but that was just a trait that was part of the German culture. And they would, for example, when they looked at the health of the individuals in the camps, they would do things like count the number of fleas on their head. Now, what function is that? Well, they just kept enormous records of what happened, and that's just a good example of probably they went to an extreme, but fortunately, they have those records, and we can therefore verify what happened.
Part of the reason, too, I believe I read in your book, Jerry, that they kept such meticulous records is because Hitler and many of his, if we can borrow this phrase, many of his devoted disciples believed that if they were successful, that the world would applaud them for what they had done, and they wanted to be able to demonstrate and teach and show how they had done it so that others would follow in their footsteps. Is that accurate?
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. In fact, Hitler made it very clear that once we have this superior race, once we've made the world a paradise, and once we eliminated all these inferior races that caused all the problems in the world, and many of the problems, then the world will be thankful for what Hitler did, and then they can then document, indeed, what the great Führer was able to accomplish. It was hard. He said, you know, it's hard. It's difficult, but it's like surgery. You don't like cutting into somebody's living body, but on the other hand, once you cut in and you remove the tumor or the ruptured appendix and sew the person up, they're thankful for what you've done. So what we're doing now is not easy, difficult. But on the other hand, the world will thank us for, indeed, what we were able to do. And so we should be proud of this. So let's document it so, indeed, we can show the world, indeed, how hard and how effectively we were able to achieve this goal of producing a superior race.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one reason why they kept such good records, but other reasons as well, but that was one reason.
Yeah. The run-up to the mass killings actually began many years prior to the start of the extermination of the Jews and the Slavs and the Gypsies and the infirmed and others. It began in April 1933. With an announced boycott of Jewish-owned businesses, and it escalated from there. I'm wondering, Jerry, if you'd tell our listeners about those early years before the death camps were in full operation, gassing people by the hundreds daily. What were the events that led up to that?
The Nazi government was concerned that there may be a lot of opposition to what they were trying to do, and so the Kristallnacht is probably the most famous example where many synagogues were burned, and many Jews were killed, and many were then put in the camps. And the German people were quite supportive, and so this encouraged the Nazis that, indeed, we can eliminate the Jews and other groups without a great deal of opposition. So what happened allowed them to carry on their programs because hardly any of us spoke out. It's often said, Edmund Burke said, good people are the reason a lot of evil happens, that evil does not happen because of bad people, because good people do nothing.
Yeah.
And that, unfortunately, is very true, and therefore Hitler was able to utilize that that fact in order to achieve what he did indeed achieve.
Mm-hmm.
And another point is that Hitler did originally not want to kill the Jews and other inferior races. He was willing to let them come to America or Great Britain or wherever they wanted to go, and he was give them passports and let them go. But America would not take very many. We took a few, but not very many. And many other countries would not take very many, if any. And so Hitler finally realized that, look, nobody else wants them. We have no choice but to kill them. So killing them was the last resort. They tried everything else. They tried over and over to get other countries to take the Jews. But other countries, including America, did not want to because America had the same eugenic ideas that Hitler did. In fact, there are a number of laws passed in America relative to immigration, and those laws limited enormously Eastern European people, Slavs, which, of course, Hitler thought were inferior. Plus, it eliminated or reduced at least the large number of Jewish immigrants that wanted to come to America. There's certainly some exceptions that were allowed, but by and large, we cut off the flow of Jews from Germany to America, and Hitler, he logically concluded, well, nobody else wants them. We have no choice. We got to kill them.
Yeah.
And so in many ways, the Holocaust, heavily the blame falls upon America and other countries.
Yeah. That what you just said, that reminded me that Darwin's evolutionary theory didn't just gain traction on the continent, but it also gained a strong foothold in the United States. And most Americans, even to this day, Jerry, are unaware that the United States Supreme Court ruled that sterilization of minorities for eugenic purposes was constitutional in 1927. Now, what's interesting about that and important for our discussion, and I'd like for you to comment on this, is that Hitler saw that, and his cabinet subsequently passed a eugenic sterilization law using the U.S. Supreme Court decision as an example, didn't they?
Right. And even the Nuremberg trials, they try to justify what they did by citing the case you mentioned, the 1927 case, which was Buck versus Bill. And that was highly influential in the Nazis being able to do what they did. They basically said, well, America's doing it. We look up to America. It's a great country. So they're doing it. Well, we're just copying. In fact, a number of American professors were flown over to Germany and given various awards by German universities because our eugenicists helped them establish their program. And in this country, there was jealousy because they did what we felt we should be doing, the scientists and eugenicists and so on, but there was a lot of opposition in this country, and the most, of course, that they were able to do was sterilize. And they sterilized, what, about 200,000 people?
Yeah.
And in my state next door, Indiana, ironically, was one of the leaders of the sterilization movement. Of course, California was supportive as well. And ironically, many churches, in particular the Methodist Church, were very supportive of these eugenic laws. And later on, they finally apologized for their important role that was played in the sterilization of several hundred thousand American women. And of course, we don't have the data, the records that Germany had, ironically.
Yeah.
So it's not known the number of sterilizations that occurred in this country, but there was clearly several hundred thousand. In fact, they occurred in up until 1967, I believe, was the last eugenic sterilization that occurred in this country.
Wow.
And ironically, many of the people who were sterilized were not retarded. In even the Buck versus Bill, Carrie Buck, the woman involved in that case, they claimed she was retarded, and turns out wasn't retarded at all. And she found out about what happened, by the way, when she married and she wanted to have a family, and she couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't know why, and so she finally went to a doctor, and they said, well, you've been sterilized. And that's the first time she learned, indeed, that she was sterilized, because they lied to her, and they said they were going to perform some necessary medical procedure, which will help her, and of course, they wasn't a necessary medical procedure. They sterilized her. In fact, the movie Hillary's America, ironically, spent a good deal of time for, I don't remember how many minutes it was, but it was a significant segment of the show which went into the sterilization of many people and why. In fact, they mentioned the Carrie Buck case and also Margaret Sanger, who was very supportive of sterilization efforts. So it's out there. In fact, the book Hillary's America goes into more detail than the movie, having a couple of chapters, if I remember right, but at least one long chapter which talked about this and why this was important as part of our history.
Yes, and there is a solid line, a solid, clear connection between the eugenics movement of this era that we're discussing and modern-day abortion. You mentioned Margaret Sanger, who's the founder of Planned Parenthood, was very much a eugenicist. In fact, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Jerry, but wasn't Margaret Sanger invited to present evidence and research about the positive aspects of eugenics to the Nazis?
Well, the Nazis and also the KKK, she did presentations before that group, and she was very supportive of what they were doing. Most of her clinics, her later on called Planned Parenthood, but her abortion clinics were opened up in black neighborhoods, and she specifically said, we want to reduce the black population, and we want to eventually eliminate these inferior people who she didn't have much respect for. So she was somewhat tactful in public, but on the other hand, her writings and her lectures do make it very clear what she wanted to do. And you talk about the Supreme Court abortion case, some of the major arguments to justify abortion were evolution.
Mm-hmm.
The evolutionists at that time and still today, some teach that we start out in life as a single-celled animal, and we develop into an amoeba, and then eventually we go through the worm stage and the frog stage and the reptile stage and so on, and They argued basically that during the time abortion occurred, the fetus was at the reptile stage, and so therefore you're not aborting the child, you're aborting your reptile. And those arguments were made by many leading American professors, such as the head of the eugenics department at the University of Michigan, and those were very important in influencing the court to indeed ultimately legalize abortion, which is now a concern among so many Christians. Roe v. Wade case is the court case that changed everything. And basically outlawed laws that, or negated laws that prohibited abortion.
Yeah. In spite of what I believe to be overwhelming evidence, there are still people who state that there's no connection between Darwinian thought on racial superiority and Hitler's application of Darwinian thought to the extermination of what Nazis described as weaker ethnicities, not worthy of surviving in the New World Order as the Nazis talked about it. That came about as a result of really propaganda in the Nazi textbooks. Darwinism in the biology textbooks was hard to miss. I mean, it was presented as fact, not theory. And so young people growing up in Germany during this time were basically indoctrinated into the Darwinian worldview. And so Hitler had a very willing and participatory nation to deal with. And we touched on this earlier, Jerry, but I think it's worth repeating that racism is very much at the core of Darwin's thought, as well as Hitler's thought, by extension, the entire Nazi Third Reich. And he revealed this plainly in his book, Mein Kampf, and I'm going to read a quote from your book. And this is on page 48 of my copy. And it says that Hitler strongly condemned both Africans and the missionaries who tried to convert them. He believed that as a result of religious teaching, humans no longer bother to breed the best for posterity, and then are full of amazement at the small effect of the Christian faith in their own country, at the terrible godlessness at this physically botched and hence spiritually degenerate rabble, and try with the church's blessing to make up for it by success with the Hottentots and Zulu Kafirs, while our European peoples fall into a condition of physical and moral leprosy. The pious missionary wanders off to Central Africa and sets up Negro missions until there too, though primitive and inferior, human beings degenerate into a rotten brood of bastards. End quote. That's Hitler from Mein Kampf. That's an amazing admission, Jerry.
Oh, yeah, there are many. And, of course, Darwin himself made many similar amazing admissions that indeed what his goal was. And it's pretty obvious. If you're going to produce this pure race, how do you do that? You do that by natural selection. Natural selection of who? Well, natural selection of the weaker individuals and the weaker races. And so it didn't take much to go from what Darwin had to say to indeed wholesale extreme eugenics or policies that basically would work at eliminating inferior races. And of course, that's what many did. I mean, Darwin was somewhat tactful. He wasn't, you know, he was pretty open, but he was somewhat tactful. In writing his book, he realized that he was putting forth a revolutionary idea, and he wanted to, you know, put forth the idea cautiously. But his followers, many people who read Darwin, knew exactly what he was talking about and applied that pretty enthusiastically to develop these programs. And that's why I think there was so little, as a whole, opposition to many, because especially the academics and biologists were fully convinced at what he was trying to do and were very supportive of Hitler's program. So he didn't have to do much encouraging to to bring about his programs. That already, he already had academia on his side, pretty much. And in fact, there are very few in academia opposers to his eugenic ideas of Hitler, as well as Charles Darwin at first, very few. The earliest one that I know of is Franz Boas. in the 40s, he basically said, this is wrong. And, of course, he was Jewish, so that would explain part of his opposition. And then Ashley Montague was another person who basically was very active in opposing the eugenic idea.
Yeah.
And it was slow, but more people got on the bandwagon, so to speak, until we had Stephen Jay Gould later on. He was a strong opposer of these ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But many of these were still Darwinists, which is ironic because they came up with reasons that would still justify all men were equal, but yet evolution occurred. But, of course, if all men are equal, how can evolution occur? Because there's nothing to select from.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have differences within the race for evolution to select. If there are no differences, there's nothing to select from, and evolution can't occur.
Yes.
So they ignored that fact, and so many basically accepted the evolutionary ideas and rejected the racism which was inherent in the evolutionary ideas. But they're not being very consistent.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier you mentioned people who deny the importance of Darwinism in Hitler's policies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these people that do that, so my experience, they're uninformed. If they really studied the whole issue, even if they watch films about this, they would realize there's a very strong connection. I've watched hours and hours and hours and hours of films about World War II, and invariably they bring it up. It may only be a sentence or two, but they bring it up that indeed Darwinian racism was central to the whole Nazi movement. And so it's there. If you look at the literature, and there's not just my book, but there are many books which make this point very, very clearly. And so I don't know any well-informed person that denies their relationship. Even the people, there is a few academics who do deny part of it, but they say, yeah, that was part of it. Racism was part of it, but there are other factors. Well, yeah, there are other factors, too. When you're trying to exterminate a race, of course, you want to bring as many factors as you can into your argument. Same as what started World War II. You try to justify it in as many ways as you can. Like the need for Lebensraum. They want land. But why do they want land? They want land because they want the superior race to increase enormously, and then they can move into that land, and then Poland and Russia and so on, that land can be taken over by Germans, the Aryan Germans, who will produce the superior race, and eventually, of course, you'll end up wiping out the non-Aryans. So even in something innocuous like Lebensraum, it's apparent what Hitler was trying to do. And people who study the works about World War II, it's pretty obvious what, you know, he's trying to do in reading these works. And like I say, there's no shortage of journal articles and well-documented books, indeed, which show that Hitler's goal was to apply evolution to society. But he would say science to society, but he meant evolution to society, Darwinism to society, and that was his core idea.
That's a very good distinction, too, Jerry. Science is not Darwinian evolutionary theory. And the inconsistencies, I mean, you've talked about them here in the last several minutes, and it always amazes me, and I've shared this with people before, how confusing it must be for our young people as they grow up through the school system in the United States to be told that they're just an accident of nature, that there's nothing special about them, that evolutionary forces are the result of mankind, and the survival of the fittest, and the strongest will survive, the king of the jungle mentality. But then when they start acting out on that, then they're told, well, we shouldn't be bullies, and we shouldn't talk bad about people. And can you imagine the confusion that the last couple of generations have experienced in trying to meld together what they're told in their biology class and ethics? Because it's very difficult to get to a morality from Darwinian evolutionary theory, isn't it?
Well, yeah, obviously, and they realize that. And so actually well-known Darwinists like Richard Dawkins actually said that evolution is evil, it's bad, and we must oppose evolution. What he's saying, though, is opposing what evolution does, not the theory, because he was very supportive of the theory, but in fact, I have another book on similar to the one that we're talking about now on Hitler and Darwinism, and I have
what's
one on morality
and Darwinism. What's the title of that, Jerry?
Well, it's not out yet. It's being edited.
Okay.
But and the publisher, people don't know this, but the publisher has a final say in a lot of these things.
It's true.
I come up with what I think is a good title, and they say, no, I don't think it's a good title. And we change
right.
it. So, but it's basically on Darwinism and how it affects morality.
Oh, wow.
Adversely affects morality.
Yes. Well, I can't wait to get a copy of that because that's a very good subject to discuss. So when that comes out, we'll be chatting again, I'm sure.
Okay, good.
So here's a question that we need to ask and answer for our listeners. What can we learn from the attempts to apply Darwinism to society, Jerry?
Well, we learn that it has caused awful things to happen. In fact, if we look at the number of people who died in wars all throughout history, you find World War I and World War II, the level of both death and, you know, mortality, but also morbidity is 600 and sometimes greater than all previous wars put together throughout history. And so World War I, World War II changed everything. Well, that's why they call it a world war.
Yeah.
Because not just the deaths, but the injuries, destruction of property, destruction of homes. There were very few people in America and Europe who were not affected directly or indirectly by World War I and World War II. In my family, I've known of several people that died as a result of the war. And I'm sure in your family, if you ask around, you probably would find relatives, cousins, or uncles and so on that died as a result of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing, of course, is true in Germany. It wiped out, 20 million German men?
Yes.
And so many that the women, there were not many eligible men to marry. So many were killed. And so that's why so many German women, of course, married Americans, because as several friends of mine told me who are German, they realized that if you want a husband, you don't have a lot of choice. Start dating one of those American servicemen because you're not going to be able to marry a German man because, 20 million were killed.
Yes.
In fact, Eisenhower did not want American servicemen to fraternize with the enemy, but the German women, and he specifically ordered them not to hang around and associate with the German women. Well, it didn't take long, and he realized that's not going to work.
Right.
You know, the American men were lonesome for female company, and the German women were likewise lonesome for male company. And they realized the main chance for a husband would be to marry an American. So after the war was over, thousands, I don't know the number, but there were thousands and thousands of German women who married Americans and came over here. I personally knew of three. One was my tutor in German language. She married American and came over to America because, well, that's her best chance she had of getting a husband.
Yeah.
And she told me that there were many women that she knew in Germany that married American men and came over and lived in America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's not uncommon.
Right.
I should look up and see how many, but I know there are quite a few.
Yeah. What do pastors and churches, Jerry, in your view, what do they need to do today to make sure that this type of thinking is challenged and never rises again to the level that it becomes a propaganda tool? What do churches and pastors need to do?
They need to preach sermons on this. And, of course, this gets into evolution, and
yeah.
a lot of pastors don't have a degree in biology, so they don't feel qualified to talk about evolution. So the role that I've taken, in fact, this last weekend I spoke to six different churches and schools, Christian schools, and the reason they brought me in to Indianapolis, actually, is where I went at Christian Heritage High School. It was one of the schools I spoke at was because they realized they really can't deal with this issue, and so they bring people like me, and there are many people out there. And I can get you names and addresses of people who will be glad to come in and talk to your church about what's going on. And my focus, I talk about the Darwinian issue and Hitler as well, but my focus is on the main problems of evolution. For example, I point out that evolution is two parts, variety and natural selection.
Mm-hmm.
Where does variety come from? Variety comes from accumulation of mutations. So basically, mutations produce variety, and natural selection selects the best from that variety that's produced. So in other words, if you think about it, we are the result of billions of mutations. That's what created us. That is what, according to evolution, is the creator. And when you put it in that way, people respond very positively because they realize that evolution is really foolish. How can you accept the idea that we are the result of billions of mutations? Well, that's what it teaches.
Mm-hmm.
And I quote, I have a number of quotes from major prominent Darwinists who basically say that. Theodosius Dobzhansky is one, Ernst Mayr is another one, and these are, you know, leading evolutionists in the world. These are among the most eminent ever lived in the field of evolution. And they came out and made it very clear that the only source, ultimately, the only source of variation is mutation. Well, mutations are damage to the genome. They're mistakes in the genome. It's like a typographical error in a paper, in a book. And how can billions of mistakes produce what we see around us in the living world, dogs and cats and people and everything else? Mm-hmm. Well, they recognize when you put it in that way, they recognize how foolish it is. And invariably, a question I get is, well, why can't you accept both evolution and accept Christianity? Well, there's such a contrast, you know, because Christianity is in many ways the opposite.
Yes.
We care for the weak, we help the sick, we help the poor, we help those that are destitute. Where evolution says, no, natural selection will call out the weak, the sick, etc. And so the two ideas are dynamically opposed.
That's right.
And unfortunately, when you compromise and say, well, I'm a theistic evolutionist, I believe that God used evolution, mm-hmm. that is a major contradiction. You mean God used death and mistakes,
that's mutation, right. Yes.
And so on to mm-hmm. create life? That sounds very much not like the God we worship.
Certainly isn't the God described in the scriptures. Well, Jerry, you mentioned just a moment ago that you've got a book that's coming out, not titled yet, but when do you expect that to be out?
Well, they said it'd be out by November, although I'm not sure. It's now being, not really proof, but before you publish a book, they want their own particular style of footnotes and manuscripts and so
yeah.
on.
Mm-hmm.
I have a person working on that now, and it should be. It'll be published by Joshua Press, the same publisher that did my Hitler, Darwinian Worldview book.
Yes.
And they do a good job. They're very thorough. They are very careful in going through it and researching and so on. But they promised me by November, but, you know, those dates aren't always very, very firm. But I have that one, and I have several others. Like one, which they did keep my title, was Darwin's Frauds, Forgeries and Blunders. And that is also supposed to be out in November. And that will be published by Creation Ministries International. And that covers a lot of the same thing, except it does cover not only his moral blunders, but also some of his other blunders, his Piltdown Man and Nebraska Man and the other well-known examples.
Yes.
And also I have a book which should also be out in November. That seems to be a magic date for finishing these projects, but that book is on C.S. Lewis, and I show that C.S. Lewis was strongly opposed to Darwinism, and he also was very concerned that science was becoming very totalitarian and very controlling, and he was concerned about the level of science and what it was doing in society, like, for example, censoring from.
Yes. Is that... what was the title of that again? Jerry, Darwin's Frauds, something in Blunders?
Yeah, Frauds, Blunder, I think of Darwin's Blunders, Frauds, and Forgeries.
Forgeries, okay. And then this book about C.S. Lewis, does that have a title?
No, they're still working on
that. They're still
that. Working Probably
on
it'll that. Be C.S. Lewis, Militant Anti-Darwinist. I think that's just the title they're going to use.
Well, those are...
Be about, go ahead.
Who's publishing that?
Whiff and Proof. Poof.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Out of Oregon.
Okay. Now, where can listeners follow your work, Jerry? Keep up to date on what's going on with you. Do you have a website or some type of social media presence where folks can follow you and stay in touch?
I have a web. I'm on, of course, Facebook, but I'm not very active. I have to spend all my time writing books because I get contracts and I get ideas and I want to get them out.
So. Sure.
But also Amazon.com, just look under my name, Jerry Bergman, and you'll get probably 15 of the books that I published. And just I publish regularly in all the creation journals, so if you subscribe to any creation journal, you will see my work.
Okay.
But Dr. Jerry Bergman, Ph.D., is a website that I have, and you can go there. But again, I don't keep it up to date because I have deadlines, and once you sign a contract, if you don't fulfill that contract, publishers get rather angry at you. So
that's right.
I need to be conscientious and sign a contract and fulfill it. So I have to do my part, and then I have to get my part in by a certain date. But of course, they can take their time with their part. But that's just the way it is.
That's right.
And so they're doing a good. The publisher I've gone with are doing a good job.
Yeah.
I have another one that just came out called "Silencing the Darwin Skeptics." And that's on Amazon. And I have another one coming out, should be out this month, called Censoring the Darwin Skeptics.
Mm.
And I have another one coming out called Atheism is the Doorway, Darwinism is the Doorway to Atheism.
Wow.
And that should be coming out, I hope, in a couple of months.
I have
a lot of projects I need to get finished.
You sure do, and you've filled up my book reading list now for the next, foreseeable future. When I get copies of those, that's going to keep me busy. Jerry, I really appreciate you being on the program with me, and I think there's still a lot that we could talk about, but we'll make that the subject matter of another episode. How's that sound?
Oh, that sounds great. I appreciate being on.
All right. Jerry, God bless you, and thank you for joining me today.
Okay, God bless you, and thanks a lot.
Thank you. Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries and is released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes, follow us on Facebook where you can discuss this episode, and of course follow Soaring Eagle Radio on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad, and listen to every episode from our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. The opening audio montage collection was created by Micah 68 Productions. You can visit them on the internet at www.mika68.com for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also contact Mike directly by email at the following address, Pastor Mike at woh.rr.com.